Hey guys, and welcome to Percussion Perspective. I'm Remy, and I'm here with my co-host Kevin. And on today's episode, we are talking about tips for a beginning percussion class.
Yeah, and last episode, if you listened to that, we talked about choosing beginning percussionists. So if you want to hear that, go back to episode number one. But we felt that moving into the beginning of the year and kind of what a beginning percussion class looks like is a really good segue for our next episode. So we have a few different topics that we're going to talk about on this episode. And our topic number one is defining behavior and organizational expectations. Before we even have our instruments, before the kids have any of their equipment, like practice pads or snare drum stands or stick bags, et cetera, you know, sometimes it takes us about a week to a week and a half to have that stuff. I will drill a lot of rhythm sheets, note identification stuff, just to make sure that by the time they do have their equipment, that they can already do a lot of rhythms and they can already, you know, identify their note names and stuff like that. So you kind of do have a lot of stuff at the beginning of the year that you can do before they even have their equipment.
Cool. So, like Kevin said, these classroom procedures are something that can be done before your students actually have their instruments. So I don't know what you do at your individual school. What we do and what a lot of programs do, they have like a rental meeting, you know, and it's usually scheduled out for like the beginning of the second week of school or something like that, so that you have a few days to make sure that kids are in the right classes, that they're in, you know, beginning brass or beginning woodwind or beginning percussion or whatever, in case there are some schedule problems. And then you have a rental night a few days later, and that's actually when all the students get their instruments and their books and sticks and mallets and stuff like that. So during that time that they don't have their instruments and their materials, you can go through these classroom procedures and just kind of set expectations. And so one of the very first things that I really try to do is just make sure that I set the expectation that this is going to be a super organized class. Percussion specifically has so many things that can go wrong between like setup, how you hold your sticks, and they just have to think about so many things. And so I try to make sure from the get-go that they understand, okay, we're going to do everything very methodically. We go through, you know, learning how to set everything up. We go through learning the layout of the classroom and all of that stuff. So just making sure that you use that time for classroom procedures.
Yeah, and I do a lot of that same stuff, just being able to explain to the kids, hey, this is a pretty serious thing that we do. You know, we want you guys to be a successful class. And so, like Remy said, setting those expectations just kind of really sets the mood for the whole year, and it'll come in handy when they actually do have all their equipment to set up. One of the biggest things I do at the beginning of the year for classroom procedures is I try to not let the kids be too social. I try to have my kids make sure they get to class, get their stuff out, and get ready to warm up. You know, as a percussionist, we have a lot of stuff to get through in a class period. And so we just want to get going pretty quick. I also, at the very beginning of the year, I don't let them get their sticks out until I tell them to, mostly so that they don't start kind of playing on their own and developing, you know, bad habits and bad technique and stuff like that. And as the year gets going, they can do that on their own. But I try to stop that until I've been able to really drill what the technique should be for that. The next part of kind of organizational expectations would be the organization of personal materials. So this is kind of once they have their music, sticks, mallets, stick bag, all that stuff, I will have my students label every piece of equipment that they have, since most of the time, all the kids have about the same stuff. You're going to have a few kids here and there that go out and buy their own stuff, or, you know, they rent different things or whatever, but most of the kids are going to have the same stuff. So you might have 10, 15, 20 kids sitting there with the exact same practice pad, the exact same stand, the exact same sticks, stick bag, mallets, all that stuff. So a lot of that seems very common sense, but I actually didn't do that for the first, I don't know, 5 years or so. And it's made a big difference when it comes to organization.
Yeah. I don't do all of that. And I probably should, because I have students most days that are like, someone stole my sticks. Like, no, nobody stole your sticks. Somebody has probably just grabbed the wrong ones. Right. But yeah, I think that's just to kind of add there before we move on to our next topic. That's just a really important thing, is to just be organized. And if you can get that in their mindset and kind of, you know, develop them from day one to be organized, that's going to carry on, you know, to their future as a percussionist when, oh, all of a sudden I'm playing three different instruments on the same piece and I have to be super organized with my setup and my music and my mallet tray and all that stuff. You know, if you just kind of put that in a kid, make sure that they're organized from day one, then it just helps them. It just sets them up for success in the future. That kind of brings us to our next topic, which we've already hinted at a little bit, but setup and tear down. So this is a really important step and can sort of set the tone for the rest of the year. As I said, it needs to be really organized, but the setup for your classroom and the setup for themselves, like I call it their station, like, hey, make sure your station is set up. And then I'll let you know what we're going to do. I'll let you know what page we're going to turn on our book or whatever. But that setup should be really clearly defined, and a tear down should exist in your class. So I build in, like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes at the end of each of my classes for them to tear down, you know, deconstruct their station. They put their practice pad and their snare stand back in their locker, or they wheel the keyboards back into the percussion storage room, and then they fold their music stands down and line them up on one side of the room. You have to make them do this a lot of the time. You have to make and that's why I said I build time in the schedule for it. Because if you don't make them do it, they will just leave the room a mess. And again, this just kind of further enshrines, you know, the expectation of being organized. And then when they get into high school and they're playing on, like, our really expensive instruments and moving those instruments around, like, it's just automatic that they put them up in the right place, in the right order. My high school kids just kind of know that expectation because it started when they were beginners.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this stuff, you just said it kind of, once they're in high school, they have a little bit more of an idea of how this should go. But just because we are percussionists and we, you know, half, if not more of our time is spent getting equipment ready, you know, moving stuff around, you know, especially right now, we're kind of in that percussion ensemble time. So we may have to steal a mallet instrument from another ensemble room or something. So the fact that they just have that idea that today I'm going to have to get ready for class, and that might involve moving some equipment around, and I need to make sure I do that quickly in a timely manner and stuff like that. Doing that stuff in beginning percussion can set the tone. And by the time they're in high school, that is just second nature to them. Remy was talking about putting stuff away, like a teardown. I think that's a fantastic tip, because at the earlier parts of the year, that is a really good thing to set in motion. And I'll give them more time for that throughout the first couple of weeks of school, just so they have,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So they have plenty of time to be like, okay, this is what it takes to get this done right. As the year goes on, I'll decrease that time a little bit to make sure that they, can still get it done, but they know how to do it quickly.
Yeah. One last tip that I had in there was, eventually, so Kevin was talking about giving them more time. You know, obviously it's going to take a while for an 11-year-old kid, 12-year-old kid to be able to set up a snare drum stand. Like, they're not super self-explanatory. But as we go, like, sometimes on, like, Fridays, like, okay, you're going to have a minute to set up, or, like, first person to get set up gets, like, a Jolly Rancher. Like, our band office, at the middle schools, they always have, like, you know, 5 giant bags of Jolly Ranchers or whatever to, like, bribe kids to do stuff. So, you know, you can sometimes, like, make a game out of it too. Like, okay, you guys have 1 minute to get set up. Anyone that isn't set up in that 1 minute, you know, loses a point for the day or whatever. You can make it as fun or as extreme as you want. But yeah, so we kind of talked about making sure that there are those expectations, but then it's like, so now what are those expectations? So you need to define those expectations, right? So define spacing between students, define your physical setup of the class. So there are a couple different ways. Hopefully you're going to start them on practice pads, you know, learning snare drum technique first. You know, I have my kids set up in an arc, but you could do like a straight line or a V or zigzags, where the kids are kind of offset if you don't have as much room to have them in one giant line. You could have, you know, two rows or whatever, but I think an arc is the best. You can see them, they can see you, they can sort of see each other because they're kind of, you know, the outsides of the arcs are kind of facing each other. And then your chair order is still visible. So they know, like, you know, I use chairs in my class, and every couple weeks we do a chair test. And so it's like, oh, if I'm on this side of the room, here are the kids that I'm going to look at because they have good technique and they're playing well or whatever. So it just kind of creates a good environment where everybody can see everybody and helps me see everybody equally. And then, you know, have them set up quietly as much as you can. Like Kevin was saying earlier, he doesn't have them get sticks out until he says. I just do what I call silent setup, and they are allowed to like whisper. And I usually play a song on like the Bluetooth speaker in the classroom that I use for a metronome, play some music or something, and give them a couple minutes. And then, you know, they just kind of know that that's the expectation. But yeah, just make sure you have a plan. Like I said, I think an arc is the best. I don't know. What do you use for your setup? Do you use an arc or do you use a straight line or?
Yeah, it'll depend on the size of my class from year to year. So like this year I have about 14 kids, and the size of my room when it has things like bass drum and timpani and stuff in it, I don't really have enough room for an arc. I agree with you. I think an arc is the best because like you said, you can see all the kids, they can see each other, and it just kind of, the flow of the room is best. You can get to every kid really easily if you need to show them a technique or fix something. But yeah, I think arc is best. Right now, I kind of have them in, I have them in about two straight lines, and I have them kind of set up in windows so I can see, you know, the kids that are behind the first row. And that's just because of the size of my room. So,
yeah.
But I think the arc is the best, like you said, for all those reasons.
Yeah. And it's not like your class is going to really suffer because of your setup. I mean, it would be stupid to have them like not, you know, face the back of the room while you're at the front of the room. They would suffer then. But yeah, this is really just kind of personal preference. And I have found that an arc is the most helpful for communication, and so everybody can see everybody. Cool. You want to take number three?
Yeah. So hopefully in beginning percussion, you are not teaching any type of grip other than matched grip. If you are trying to teach,
I thought you were going to say any grip. Hopefully you're not teaching any grip.
Hopefully they aren't holding the sticks yet. I'm just kidding. Yeah. So obviously matched grip for a beginning percussionist should be standard. That's just what we do.
And we should say real quick, sorry. We should say real quick for anybody that doesn't know what matched grip is, you probably do know what it is. You just might not know that it's called that. So I don't want to assume that someone doesn't know, but I also don't want to assume that everybody does know. So match grip is just where each hand is holding the stick the same way. They're match. The hands match.
Oh, that's why it's called that.
You did. Yeah. You didn't know that?
Makes sense. I'm just kidding. So yeah, so this is after they've gotten the grip of setting up and tearing down. Then you're going to, like, the first thing you need to do is how to hold the stick. So less is usually more when it comes to this. You don't need to go into some long explanation of the grip and what each finger does. Hopefully, when you tested those kids, one of the aspects that you used was holding onto the stick. So a lot of those kids should be able to just, you know, if you hold your sticks up, show them, make sure you show the back and the front of your hand, they should be able to kind of copy that technique. So kind of just introduce it quickly, you know, like a 1 minute spiel, and then let them go on their own. And then, you know, you can start making those corrections if you need to. But most of the time with that, if you kind of chill on the like talking about a bunch of mistakes they might make or mentioning problems that aren't even there, you can pretty much get the majority of your class doing it right pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's one thing that I learned from a professor in college is, like, don't mention mistakes if they aren't there. Don't be like, okay, now don't hang those pinkies off the back of the sticks. Make sure you keep them wrapped around. Like, if nobody's doing that, don't even let them know that that's an option. Sometimes by, like, over-explaining, you just end up creating problems that you then have to deal with. So yeah, I totally agree with that. Some of the terminology or just like the buzzwords or the phrases that I use for setup, I try to keep it pretty simple. Obviously, you have to teach them what a fulcrum is, right? That's like the foundation of our grip. That's where your thumb and your index finger make contact with the stick, add a little bit of pressure, and that's where the stick is rotating. That's the point that the stick is rotating around. So I do go into a little bit of detail on that, usually draw like a teeter-totter on the whiteboard behind me and like, oh, this point in the middle is a fulcrum. The teeter-totter goes around it. So this point on in your hand is the fulcrum of our grip, and that's what we are hanging onto the stick with. And then I also kind of talk about the front of the hand versus the back of the hand. So the front of the hand would be where their fulcrum is. The back of the hand is the other end, the back fingers. So like, you know, your pinky, your ring, and your middle finger. And that's helpful because when you start introducing like buzzes or double strokes or diddles and things like other rudiments like that, you can tell them, hey guys, get to the front of your hand a little bit more, add a little bit less pressure in the backhand and add more pressure to the front. They know what you're talking about. And then the other two things that I scream all the time are 90 degrees and downward angle. So like 90 degrees between the sticks, right? Everybody knows that. And a downward angle, you know, from your elbow all the way down to the bead of the stick. That way, whenever they play those, you know, lower strokes, those tap strokes or whatever you want to call those, that they can manage their heights. So yeah, fulcrum, 90 degrees, downward angle, front and back of hand. Those are kind of those buzzwords that I use a lot during class.
And a lot of times, depending upon what kind of sticks that you have your beginners get, they will have some kind of mark on the stick that you can use for them to have that fulcrum set on. So they can have their thumb, you know, on the sticks that I use, there's an American flag on the sticks. And so you can just tell them, hey, put your thumb over the flag. And that generally is the right spot.
Yeah. Or if you don't have something like that, usually there's at least going to be like a brand name or maybe like a signature, like if they're like a signature brand. So it's like, hey, put them on the R or the S or whatever, you know, like put your thumb around that area and at least gets them a checkpoint. If you don't have anything, generally like 1/3 up the stick though is kind of the sweet spot. Every stick's going to be a little bit different just based on the weighting, but 1/3 from the butt end of the stick is going to get you in the right zone for sure. And that's for not just for match grip, but for pretty much all, you know, all grips, which there is like one other, but anyway.
Yeah. And that grip pretty much is associated with the majority of percussion grips. So when you start talking about mallets, you start talking about concert bass drum, timpani, like a lot of it is essentially the same fulcrum. So you're not wasting time by being really precise on where they hold the stick and the grip and just being loose versus tense and all that stuff it's a really good use of your time.
Yeah. I was going to add right there. We didn't really say why to use match grip. I mean, we're kind of being tongue in cheek when we're saying don't teach traditional grip to your sixth graders, but you know, match grip is the standard to start with. And it's easily transferable to everything else. So when you start keyboard or timpani or anything, like Kevin said, you're playing wood, like, you know, wood blocks on sleigh ride, you're going to use match grip. So it's just the best thing to start with. We can move on to number 4, which is set in quotation marks and check in quotation marks. Most of you are probably familiar with set and check. Maybe you call it like attention and relax, or I've heard it called like ready position, rest position, but set and check is what I learned in marching, or what I learned in school when I was young, and that we use that all the way through marching band. And I just use that with my students. I think it's pretty universal. You know, define those attention positions and what your expectations are. So, you know, set should include the proper grip once they learn that. And check is kind of up to you. I usually have sticks down at the side, unless a kid just like cannot stop hacking, cannot stop playing while they're not supposed to be. I'll say like, hey, can you put your sticks on your pad, or can you put your sticks on your music stand or whatever? But set and check should be defined early. And actually that week before they have instruments, you could kind of teach them set and check a little bit, just as an attention thing. Like, we're going to learn how to count these rhythms, and I want you to stand at set while we're counting, and then I'll tell you relax. That just kind of gets that ingrained in their brain already. It does help. I do notice if I, call my students to set and they are really like lazy about it, takes a long time. I'm like, hey, that took too long, so why don't we relax? And then we go back to set, and then it does help, like helps them focus a lot of the time too. So just making sure that you are defining those expectations. Again, that goes all the way back to kind of that day one expectations, but set and check are something that you should definitely use. Don't just let them choose their own playing position and their own relaxing position.
Yeah. And by having a good set and check position, you're kind of giving your kids a chance to check their own posture, check their hand position, check their 90 degree angle, check their downward angle from their arm down to their stick. It just gives them a chance to check all that out, so that as they get older, they naturally go to that good playing position. Another thing I wanted to add about kind of their playing position was, I don't know what Remy does, but I like to have them put their right foot forward a little bit and kind of lean back on their back foot, so that they can free up their front foot so that they can tap it. So that, again, they can use that for tempo maintenance and stuff like that. Is that what you do?
Yeah, that's something that I have sort of struggled with, and I've tried it a couple different ways. I kind of just tell them feet should roughly be, shoulder width apart. But if you need to offset a foot, you just need to be able to tap your foot somehow. And I know kind of like the band world expectation is tap your toe down, up, ready, go. But I think it's more comfortable when you're standing to tap your heel. That's a little bit easier for me. Just kind of bob your knee a little bit for your heel to go up and down. But yeah, I kind of leave that up to them, but I do say tapping your heel is a little bit more comfortable. And I think most of my students do that.
Yeah. And I think you may have kids that are like, oh, that's not very comfortable to do it like that. And it's like, okay, well, what feels comfortable for you? And let's figure it out so that you can have a good tempo keeping strategy.
Yeah. Or you're like, well, how you've done that for 5 seconds. So of course it's not comfortable. So
I love, I love when they go, that hurts my ankle.
Or just anything, like fix your technique. Like, but it feels weird. It's like, well, that's good. If it feels weird, yeah, it means that it's different from what you were doing. So
you've never done this before, kid.
Me neither. Yeah, I think that's about it on check. I like the foot tapping in there. I forgot to talk about that. So that's a good thing. And again, that's one thing that hopefully transferred from your beginning percussion testing was, okay, you're not really going to have to teach these kids how to tap their foot in time. Now, when you get into like, rhythms that don't line up with the feet all the time, downbeat, upbeat type stuff, that coordination might take a little bit, but again, hopefully you've chosen kids that can pick it up quickly, and every year I do have one or two kids that struggle with it quite a bit and like, okay, well, how did you do this, 6 months ago? But most of the time they end up figuring it out.
Yeah. The next big thing with that is just make sure you don't start letting the kids play out of turn, or what we like to use as hacking. Your kids are going to want to do that because they have these sticks in their hands and they just have this practice pad in front of them that they want to hit. So one little tip I use with that is I try to make them feel bad for ruining their classmates' education by making noise. Instead of just...
I try to make them feel bad.
And I don't mean that in like a rude way, but it's just like, hey, if a kid just consistently is hacking, playing out of turn, or they're talking, blurting out answers or whatever they're doing that is causing the distraction, I'll just say, hey, turn around. Look, you've got 14 other kids in this room. You are ruining their class every single time you decide to just blurt out, or you decide to play as loud as you want. And I'll even demonstrate, like if I have a music stand in front of me, I'll just start hitting the music stand and then try to teach. And I'll be like, were you able to hear what I just said? And they're most of the time like, no. And I'm like, that's exactly what it's like when you blurt. So I don't think that playing out of turn and hacking is ever going to go away, but it's something that you want to, again, just get a hold of it at the beginning of the year. And generally you may only have problems with one or two kids. And it's also pretty cool when the kids start to get onto each other. I have a couple of kids that when another kid is screwing around playing out of turn, they will call them out on it and be like, hey, be quiet or whatever. So
yeah, I've got those same mad dog kids. But yeah, hacking again, it's a problem in every year in every class. And so you just got to do what you can to make it stop. You know, we could do a whole other episode on strategies for that. But usually what I do is I just send them back to check, make them go back to set. Like, okay, wasn't that annoying? Cause you're not going to get that 8 seconds back of your life. And then we move on. So the next topic, very beginning of class. So most of the time I will give them an extra minute. Yeah, I do that every day. 5 minutes, you know, especially at one of the middle schools I teach at where the beginners are, they like all the sixth grade classes are up on the fourth floor and then they have to come all the way down to the first floor where the band room is. And so as long as they just get in the room by the time the bell rings, I'm good with that. And then I do give them an extra minute, you know, or even at the beginning, I really don't even give them a time limit. It's just like, hey, we've got about 5 minutes to set up. And then that just decreases to like a minute by the time they should know how to set up. I always immediately start with some kind of warm up. I always start with like 8 on a hand. So I'll set a timer or I'll just say, hey, you got 30 seconds left. And I just kind of estimate that time in my head, or seeing Stars and Stripes Forever for a few seconds. And, go ahead and start with 8 on a hand, right? Start with that first warm up. And then the rest of the ones are like, oh crap, I got it. Okay. They feel bad or they feel like they're missing out or it makes it more obvious that like, okay, I should have been ready by now.
I started that this year. Like just, I don't start with any talking or announcements. I'm just like, hey, all right, we're starting about 30 seconds. And I just turn the metronome on and I go. And just like you said, it makes the kids who aren't ready kind of hustle. And hopefully if they're with it enough, like we talked about in the first episode, they will begin to get to class faster and get stuff ready. So they don't miss the warm up. Cause it makes a big difference. I don't know if it's true, but I feel like I have more time in class once I get the warm up done quickly instead of talking.
Yeah. There are those days when like the kids are not ready and it's like, okay guys, it's 15 minutes into class and we're still trying to make it through our warm up sequence. And so just again, making that part of your procedures and going back to the beginning of our conversation today, making that part of your procedure for the class and like, okay, I'm going to give you, you know, this many times. And like, I often find myself asking the question, how long does it take to set up a practice pad? And they're like 30 seconds. Like, yeah. Okay. So why has it taken you 3 minutes and you're sitting there on your computer or whatever, like, just get set up right. And let's go. So yeah, I think starting with a warm up immediately is a good strategy. Just, you know, let them know the expectation and just don't differ from that unless there's like, you know, a fire or something. So play eights unless the room is on fire. That's what is tattooed on my arm.
That's good. So yeah, I'll lead us into our last topic, which is what to make it through in a class period. So we'll go through this pretty quick. But like I said, starting off the class with a warm up, and as the class gets going, as the year progresses, that warm up can get a little bit longer. But I always start with some kind of legato, so rebound strokes. We have an exercise called 8-4-2-1 that I then added a 3 in there just to challenge them. So 8-4-3-2-1. I know that is what everyone's going to get out of the podcast today is
adding three
on a hand. And then the next exercise that we'll add right into that most of the time is like a single paradiddle, double paradiddle and paradiddle diddles just to start getting those sticking combinations in their hands. And this is not even written out with music in the book that I use. It's just written out with stickings. And I have found that doing those three, starting to get the paradiddles in there, just start to free up their mind of stickings being complicated. And it starts to kind of just make them a little bit more, stronger on the sticking topic. And I do a fun little challenge with this. So once they learn one of them, I'll do like a tempo challenge. And so every time that we do these, I'll be like, okay, who went home and practiced at this tempo or the newer tempo? And then I kind of keep I have like, okay, one kid did it at whatever, 100. And then, oh, one kid did it at 101. Sometimes they beat them by one point. But I do little tempo challenges, and that makes, even if only half the kids go home and attempt the challenge, that's at least getting them to practice more. And then, you know, they'll come back to class and try it, and I'll have a new first place every day. And I kind of do these on like a monthly basis. I'll be like, okay, at the end of February, whoever can play the single paradiddle the fastest, I'll go like to Quick Trip and get them some kind of, you know, some kind of treat. I won't get gas for them. I told them that though.
Yeah, too expensive. Get them
like a gallon of gas. But and then the next thing I'll want them to be able to do, and this is kind of the warmups that like we're doing now. But obviously this will progress as they learn these things, but we'll do like some kind of buzz exercise. It takes a long time for them to get, you know, a buzz roll developed. So we'll do like a 4-4 buzzes, and then we'll go into a 4-4 doubles that works on their double strokes. And then we normally will pop up an old rhythm sheet and kind of get into that. So that's a good, like just a warm up. And I know that seems like a lot of stuff, but I generally can go through all of that in about 5, 10, 15 minutes, depending on how well they play. And then the next thing I would do is probably a new rhythm sheet. Like if we're going to learn a new rhythm, then I'll pop that rhythm sheet up. I have a TV in my room that is connected to my Chromebook, and I will do a new rhythm sheet. And then after that, we will do any old material. So if we learned a rudiment or whatever we may have learned in the past, we'll kind of start reviewing that. And then we'll do new material. So a new rhythm sheet or a new rudiment, that's kind of where I'd be popping in those new, like if we're going to learn 9-stroke roll, 5-stroke roll, whatever we're going to learn, we'll do that. Then we just kind of continue following the flow of our percussion book. So whatever our book is going to do next, we will do that. And then I like the new book that I switched to. It did start to include some small accessory lessons in there. So being able to throw in 10-15 minute tambourine day where you talk about it. And then normally that matches up with a snare drum piece or a mallet piece. And I guess we should have mentioned mostly today is kind of like what a snare drum day looks like. Not really so much mallets. That can probably be a different
yeah,
topic.
I mean, you know, we're talking about like from the beginning of a beginning percussion class. And so I do know some people that start on mallets, but I'll just say I disagree with that. I think you should start on snare drum, on pads. And so, yeah, this is kind of like at the beginning of the year, what you should do, you know, with that percussion thing. So, or with that beginning percussion class, I don't know why I called it a percussion thing. Yeah. This is a general day, just an average day when we're on snare drums. By this point in the year, you know, we're a month into the second semester or so. And so we, you know, we've been playing keyboards for a little while now, but we still alternate through snare drum and keyboard every few days.
One of the biggest things I've just kind of figured out is the kids don't need you to really talk that much. Just especially right at the beginning, like there are a lot of comments you're going to give, but the kids need to play. They need to be getting that experience, because you know, what if half of your class never practices at home for a while, then they need that class time. So play. You don't have to talk that much.
That goes back to those comments at the beginning. Like don't say things right that you don't need to, just, you know, less is more.
Yeah. And then after you've kind of done on that, just remember if it's toward the beginning of the year, you're going to want to give them that time to pack up. So making sure they're putting up their stuff. I always try to make sure they don't start packing up early. Kind of those kids can sense the end of class time. So you don't want to let them pack up. One of the biggest takeaways, this is my 10th year of teaching a beginning percussion class. I teach more than that, but one of my biggest takeaways is that the kids can learn faster than I used to think. I used to kind of think that I would wait till most of the students, at least I thought they had perfected a concept, but that's really not how it can work. The kids can learn faster than you think. So I've gotten a lot better at introducing new topics just on a faster pace. And I feel like I'm having a lot of success with that because I'm introducing more concepts faster throughout the year.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, like what, you know, rhythm are you guys on? Have you guys gotten through all the 16th rhythms yet?
Yeah. Yeah. We've gone through one ti ta. And yeah, we haven't done like one ti ta two.
Okay. Yeah. We just finished. Dang it. You're ahead of me just a little bit. We're about to start one tetas this week.
Yeah. And I feel like it's just every year is different. Like I feel like I just have a really good class this year. Like they're just learning fast, and not that every single kid is perfect at all of it,
but the majority of them kind of seem like they're getting it. That's good, man.
Yeah.
Cool. This was a fun one.
yeah, do you have any quick last things to add to that?
I don't think so. I hope we got it in an organized way, you know, a sequence, a succession that was easy to follow. But yeah, again, as always, questions and comments are welcome. If you have anything to add to the conversation, we'd love to hear it. And yeah, you want to sign us off since I started it today?
Yep. Thank you guys for listening, and we hope that you come back for episode 3. See you later.
Bye. Thank you.